Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 192 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Before you know it, we'll be at 200 episodes and climbing. We have three cases today. Two are from the Seventh Circuit, and we have one from the Illinois Appellate Court. First case today is from the Illinois Appellate Court, 5th District, Progressive Universal Insurance Company versus Lonsdale. The second is from the Seventh Circuit, Lobianco versus Bonefish Grill, LLC. And the third is from the Seventh Circuit as well, Martin versus Goodrich Corporation. Turning to our first case, Progressive Universal Insurance Company versus Lonsdale before the Illinois Appellate Court, 1st, 5th District. It is a case involving the Peppers Doctrine, and Pat had asked Dolly, I believe, for a picture, and it had a scale with a big red chili pepper on it. So in any event, sometimes AI is not yet fully aware of what's going on. In Lonsdale, the court will consider whether...
And I even put in Pepper's Doctrine, and it still gave me a chili pepper.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, why the hell didn't it give me Anthony Kiedis? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Flea could be up there, you know. No Flea.
Yeah.
Just...
And speaking of them, I saw them last night. I'm out in Phoenix
today. I
was going
to say that, yes.
So Willie Nelson's on the road again, and so, yep, there we go. In Lonsdale, the court will consider whether the circuit court abused its discretion and stay in the coverage case pending the outcome of the underlying tort case, because there is an ultimate issue in the coverage case that could collaterally stop the parties in the underlying tort case. An interesting appellate issue, too. There's no transcript of the hearing on the motion to stay. Pat raised a question on LinkedIn to some of our LinkedIn appellate friends. Does that confer a presumption of the propriety of the circuit court's reasoning? Pat, tell us about this interesting case.
Thanks, Dan. And so the issue here is, so under the Peppers Doctrine, so Peppers stands for a couple different propositions. One of them is this part of the doctrine, which deals with whether you stay the underlying case. The other part of it is what amounts to Illinois' version of Kumis counsel, which is independent counsel. Kumis is the Illinois or the California case that talks about the need for independent counsel where underlying defense counsel could steer the discovery into or out of coverage. And so the issue, so there really are two sides of the same coin, or two sides of the same pepper, as the case may be. And in this case, it seems that the trial court just kind of said, yeah, let's stay it and figure out what happens. So this is an underlying automobile accident. And the issue in the coverage is whether the car that was being driven was an insured vehicle. I can't for the life of me see how, whether the vehicle she was driving was insured could collaterally, and so the reason for the Peppers, I mean, back up for a second, reason for the collateral, the Peppers Doctrine is that if you decide certain issues in the coverage case, that could collaterally stop the parties in the underlying case. And because you don't want to do that, you want to have the facts and the issues decided in the underlying case, not in the coverage case. You stay the coverage case pending the outcome of the tort case. And then if there are things that are decided, then the plaintiffs, or the parties rather, in the coverage case are going to be stopped from whatever the findings of fact were in the underlying tort case. So, and you look at this based upon the allegations of the underlying complaint and whether there's a duty to defend is triggered. Now, obviously, the duty to defend was triggered. They filed a complaint for declaratory relief saying that there was no coverage, but I can't imagine that it really matters to the ultimate outcome of the underlying case whether she was driving a Ford Bronco, one she borrowed from Al Callings, or whether she was driving a Ferrari, one of which was covered and one which wasn't. I just don't understand why it matters in the underlying tort case. Obviously, it matters in the coverage case, But in any event, the trial court stated pending the outcome. The standard here is very difficult. Abuse of discretion. So I think the insurance company's got a difficult battle, but makes their battle even more difficult is that they didn't have a transcript of the hearing. And as so I asked some folks, you know, does this create a presumption? And the universal response, there were many responses, but a couple that said, yeah, there is, under Fouch versus O'Brien. And I, you know, didn't think about this, but yeah, under Fouch, you're stuck if you don't have a transcript as to the reasoning in a case where you're dealing with abuse of discretion. If you were dealing with de novo, doesn't matter as much.
Yep.
But if where you're dealing with manifest weight as the burden or as the standard of review, or you're dealing with abuse of discretion, as is the case here, then you've got to have the reasoning. And you've got to show, did the court apply the right law? Did the court, you know, what did the court do and why did it do it? And not having the transcript here could be fatal to the appeal. The court may just throw up its hands and we don't know what he did. We can't, we don't have a bystander's report. We don't have a transcript. We have nothing to tell us what they did and what the trial court did and why it did it. So how can we find that the trial court abused its discretion when we don't know what it did and why it did it? So an important, an interesting case here, because we have both the this interesting coverage issue made all the more fun by AI. We'll talk about AI here in our third segment. Yeah. My experiences with AI recently, as of yesterday, and then this other, this appellate issue. So a lesson on what not to do in some cases. In this circumstance. Dan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so no, I agree with you, Pat. It's interesting, and I was wondering the same thing. I don't know what type of car she's driving has any collateral estoppel effect, but maybe they're missing something here. I don't know. It'd be interesting to figure out when the opinion comes out, if there's anything that kind of gives us more insight.
Right, and in defense, or in defense of the insurance coverage lawyer, which, I mean, I should defend the insurance coverage lawyer. What defines whether this is covered or not, or whether the doctrine applies or not? Is you're going to take the allegations of the complaint, compare it to the policy, and you figure it out. I can understand why he took the position that. Doesn't matter what his reasons were. I know it's abuse of discretion, but ultimately it's de novo,
right?
Because you're looking, it's really de novo because you're comparing the two documents. And if there either is or isn't coverage, there either will or will not work an estoppel, a collateral estoppel on the parties in the tort case. And those are questions of law. But the reasoning on a motion to stay is almost always, or the review of that is almost always, an abuse of discretion. So we will see what happens. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with LoBianco versus Bonefish Grill.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiuminpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment two of episode 192, and the judges of the Seventh Circuit get to do slip and fall cases sometimes. And boy, do they love that, just like the district court judges do. That is the situation in LoBianco versus Bonefish Grill, where the question presented is, quote, whether the district court erred when it granted Bonefish Grill's LLC's motion for summary judgment as to Terry LoBianco's negligence claim under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 56 on the basis that the evidence presented by Terry is insufficient to demonstrate proximate cause. The district court premised its opinion on the insufficient testimony that water on the floor caused the plaintiff to fall. The circuit court judges did not seem to agree. The district court did find that the statement of an unidentified waitress that she told other staff to wipe up the water was sufficient to create notice, but that was not cross-appealed. Dan, tell us about the case.
Thanks, Pat. And it was an interesting case. It was at the beginning of it, the mic was open, and the judge told one of the advocates, it looks like you dropped your pen on the way back to your table.
That was that was from the prior argument. But yes,
prior argument, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
So this is it's an interesting case. This person, Terry, she fell at a bonefish. She was with her family.
Didn't fall on a bonefish.
No.
She fell at a bonefish.
At a bonefish grill, right? And she fell on what apparently was water or something on the floor. There's a mystery wait staff or staffer at the place that said, I told them to clean that up. One of the judges referred to that as a lot of this case at the district court hinged on the unidentified waitress that came to the table afterwards. And it's bizarre, Pat, because you would think if she fell and got back up, kind of like with the Walmart case, that at the time of it, that they would have identified this person or you know, the mystery bonefish shirt-wearing person. And maybe it was a famous a customer who really loves bonefish. We used to have one by our not far from our house, and my wife really liked bonefish. But that was one of the mysteries. And what happened at the district court level was that depositions and everything else is that the sisters corroborated that this person was identified as a bonefish employee, and the district court relied on that heavily. The appellant here was arguing that that was evidence of a breach, that something on the floor should not have been there. It's the common slip and fall, like you said, Pat, that judges everywhere love these cases. One of the things that was in dispute was she said it was water. Later asked if she was sure it was water. She didn't know what liquid it may have been. The appellee had a pretty interesting argument, I would say, in this case. And the argument was this, that in order for you to be able to claim a slip and fall on liquids in a place, you have to be able to feel or sense the liquid. And the judges were like, what are you talking about? Like, people, that's why we have shoes. One of them said, I believe was the exact almost quote, is that people wear shoes. And so what kind of sensory perception would you have that you slipped and fell? And what the appellee's lawyer was saying was, what happened here was the only way she knew that there was liquid or sensed that there was liquid was that when she got up, her dress was wet. And so that alone is not sufficient proximate cause or evidence that there was in fact some liquid on the floor. And again, I'm not sure it matters if it's whether it was water or grease or you name whatever the substance is. But after she fell, her dress was wet.
I don't know how her dress being wet tells you what she slipped on. That means that there was
water
on
right,
her.
Right.
It doesn't tell me much.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, because again, it could have been that
and the water wasn't noticed till she got to the hospital when her husband pointed it out. It wasn't
right.
Even at the scene.
Right. Right.
So I don't understand what the wet dress has to do with anything. I mean, look on the floor and see what you fell on. Is
right.
It really complicated?
Well, right. You know, if you fell, and again, you would. That's what I would do if I slip. I mean, when I've slipped on sidewalks and I've walked, I look to see what the hell I slipped on, if it was black ice or, you know, a crack or whatever.
Or if I didn't already know I was walking on ice, as I was this morning as I came into the office, there were patches of ice out there on the street. It's like, okay, I'm going to be careful here. Hopefully I don't fall and break my head. I didn't, fortunately. I have in the past, so.
Yeah, and again, there was evidence that she was not inebriated. And so the Like I said, the appellee's main argument was the key issue is whether there was sufficient evidence of proximate cause that she stepped in water or whatever substance. The judge asked the appellee immediately whether they were arguing that the type of liquid matters, and the appellee advocate said, no, that's not the case. Like you said, Pat, the argument of the bonefish attorney was there's no direct evidence of stepping in water or whatever substance. And again, just because the dress was wet when she got to the hospital or whatever, she's assuming she fell in water. And I guess here, but she went into the split, she fell over. The thing that, again, I think the appellee was trying to drive home is that it many things are possible, but in order to find liability for bonefish, it has to be not just possible, but probable. And so, case. On rebuttal, there was a reference, I think it was the Cabernet case, I think it is what I wrote down. I got that case name wrong. In that case, talked about when slipped, it's not a sensory thing. I'm not required to feel the actual liquid that you fell on. But again, it's just one of these interesting things where you would think that the sisters or somebody would have tried to look to see, like you said, Pat, what in the hell she fell on? Was it water? Was it was it grease?
What have you?
Take a picture of it with your phone, maybe. You know, there was testimony again that these floors were not slip resistant, that there was a lot of slipping going on. And again, I don't know where this took place in relation to the front hostess or anything. So it's just an interesting case.
It is. Well, we'll see. It's going to get reversed, I think, almost certainly. But so we'll have a chance to learn more about it when we read the opinion. But I'm not sure I buy it, but we'll see.
No.
So with that, we'll take our next break and come back with Martin versus Goodrich Corporation.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to segment 3 of episode 192 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Only the Seventh Circuit in the Supreme Court of the United States are allowed to certify questions of state law to the Illinois Supreme Court. That is what is provided for by Rule 20 of the Illinois Supreme Court rules. As a consequence, issues of state law in federal district court have to be certified to the Seventh Circuit, and then, if that court chooses, they then certify to the Illinois High Court. That just may happen in Martin versus Goodrich Corporation, where the district court certified the following questions relating to whether a claim could be made against an employer by an employee for asbestos following the enactment of Public Act 101-006 for review. Question 1, whether 820 ILCS 310/1F is a statute of repose, and 2, if so, whether constitutional due process prohibits applying 820 ILCS 310/1.1, the section 1.1 exception, to deny defendants their right to assert statute of repose and exclusivity defenses, which vested in 1976, and allow plaintiff to assert common law claims against defendants that had been previously and permanently barred. Pat, tell us about this case.
It's a really important case. I wrote about it in my column in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin this past week. I wrote about this amendment to the statute back in 2020 with the late Ed Matuszek. And I linked to those columns in my LinkedIn.
Great lawyer.
Great lawyer. And It was very sad. But I had the privilege of knowing him very little, doing him a little bit, and getting to work on that column with him on an issue that was really important. One mistake, and it's mine. Dan said asbestos. Asbestos was not at issue in this case. It was vinyl chloride. Principle is the same, though. Delay time between exposure and disease. Plainly, Public Act 101-0006 was written with asbestos in mind, but this particular case doesn't deal with asbestos. Before we get further, funny thing happened yesterday. I get an alert that my firm linked to an article that I had been quoted in, and I've got air quotes over quoted. And I looked at the article that I had been, quote, quoted in, and it didn't just misquote me. It gave quotes that I didn't give, said things I didn't say. Now, they weren't far off from what I had said, both in my column and in my LinkedIn posts. But I had never talked with this quote journalist. I'm not even sure they're a real person. It seems the entire website, BNN Breaking News, is a bot driven by AI. Clever, great. They got my name. They spelled my name right. Spelled my firm name right. That's good. But I could do without the improper attribution. As I said, this wasn't the worst improper attribution, but improper attribution nonetheless. So there's that. So if you see me being quoted in that particular publication, such as it is, don't pay it mind. I didn't say that. As I said, it's not out of line with what I did say and what I did write and what I'm going to say now, but I didn't say those things. So it's more of a warning about be careful what you read. And what you see, because what you see, you can't necessarily believe that either with deep fakes and whatnot. So, what's this all about? The plaintiff was first exposed to vinyl chloride, which apparently is a carcinogen, in 1966. And I say about a carcinogen as Dan polishes off the last bit of his Pepsi. So good job, Dan. No carcinogens there.
Hope not.
Hope not. Yeah, well, if there are, I'm going to get plenty of them from Coke. I'm a Coke guy, but yes.
I am too, but when you're on the road... Available. Pepsi's, it'll always say, is Pepsi okay? No, it's not, but, you know.
It's better than water.
It is.
I'm not sure about that. I would drink the water. Anyway, so this vinyl chloride, he last was exposed in 1974, but then wasn't diagnosed with liver cancer until 2019 and then died in July of 2020. So you have this very long delay in exposure, and the question is when we wrote about this, and that this continues, is that this was at an employment site or employment. Does it overcome the exclusive remedy of workers' compensation, or is he allowed to bring a civil action, which is what he did? And the trial court, strike that, the district court certified these questions to the Seventh Circuit because these are plainly questions of state law. I'd be very surprised if these don't get certified to the Illinois Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Frankly, surprised it hasn't come up in Illinois State Court already for it to work its way through, but it's in federal court, and I don't know why the Seventh Circuit would even try to answer these questions.
No.
I think it wants to, you know, as it did in the Cathrone case, it wants to have an opinion that certifies and kind of sets forth what it thinks and then sends it over. They did that also in the Alexander case that we talked about. So this is not infrequent, but the Illinois Supreme Court regulates who can give them questions. In other words, the Sixth Circuit can't certify questions of Illinois law to the Illinois Supreme Court. The district court, if it has for some reason, you know, in another circuit, has a question of a certified question that it would like to set of Illinois law that it wants to certify. Let me ask this, Dan. Could a court in the Northern District of Ohio certify a question to the Seventh Circuit?
No.
I wouldn't think they could.
I don't think so.
Okay, they could certify it to the Sixth Circuit. Could the Sixth Circuit send it to the Seventh Circuit?
I don't think so.
I don't think they could do that either.
Right.
So don't get any questions of Illinois law outside of Wisconsin, Illinois or Indiana in federal court. Otherwise, you're not going very far with getting an answer from the Illinois Supreme Court. So I don't know why Illinois is so restrictive in that view. I mean, plainly, if there is an issue in federal court that concerns Illinois law, it's likely to come from the Supreme Court of the United States or the Seventh Circuit. But if you have a question in the district, say the Northern District of Ohio, as I said, it gets certified to the Sixth Circuit. Sixth Circuit, I suppose, could certify it to the Supreme Court of the United States, and then the Supreme Court of the United States could certify it. So we can do this Rube Goldberg device to get it back to Illinois. But forum nonconvenience, people, is how you do this. Anyway, the question is whether he's limited. It's really complex, the interactions of these statutes, what they do, what they're not intended to do. Are there one statute of repose, or as the plaintiff seems to argue, two statutes of repose? I don't understand even how that would work, how you could have two statutes of repose. That seems a bit bizarre. But this is a really important case. That's why we wanted to highlight it. It also is interesting. The Seventh Circuit had this, you know, direct issue of Illinois law on the same day, I think, as it had the LoBianco case. So they were steeped in Illinois law for a day and probably not very happy about it. They'd prefer, I imagine, to stick with the federal law things they're used to. But this one's going to probably be off to off to the Illinois Supreme Court before too long. Dan, what are your thoughts?
No, I agree with all that, Pat. And it's interesting because one of the things, you know, I guess makes sense, but I wasn't aware of, and I mentioned to you, is the statute of statutes. Statute on statutes, which I guess every state has, but it's just kind of an interesting thing that you have to think about, that the legislature's put in place something that talks about how statutes operate.
Well, yeah, because you need, like, the definition of days.
Right.
What's a day?
Right.
You know, what's a, this kind of a thing. That's the kind of thing that's in statute, the definitions of different words that's used throughout the code. Otherwise, you have to define it in every code, and it'd be a nightmare.
Yep. So, anyway.
So, with that, we'll turn to BIPA, BI, GIPA, and IPA. And Dan, why don't you tell us about the decision that came out on February 15th, and I'll tell us about the oral argument that day.
Yeah. So, Judge Leinenweber had a case. What happened?
Who is the least senior of a senior judge? And I say that not because he's not a great judge, just because his caseload seems enormous. Because his cases are always beaten up. So he's senior status. Typically, you have fewer cases.
Not him.
Not him. He seems to have a full load.
He does. And so this case involves Samsung and biometric information privacy cases. What happened was there was more than 800 filings against Samsung with the AAA because Samsung has in place, like many of these consumer-facing companies, and we've mentioned this before, Pat, I do a lot of consumer cases for the AAA. And again, there's benefits of ADR. It's non-precedential. There's no class actions. But the provision
It's confidential sometimes.
Confidential. But it requires what's required here is that the claimants in each of these cases, like 800 and some cases or 900 cases, they file their claims and their demand for arbitration with the AAA. And the mechanism in a consumer context is that the respondent, the company such as Samsung, they pay the administrative fees. And in this case, it's 300 and some bucks per case. So Samsung got a bill for $311,000. And Samsung's told AAA, we're not paying that. AAA, what they do is if they don't get paid by the respondent companies in these cases, they close the files. And this case then went to before Leinenweber. And Leinenweber, in a pretty stern opinion, I wrote about it for Monday's Daily Law Bulletin column in part, wrote about a little bit other things, but I mainly wrote about this case. Because it's a huge case in terms of what happens. And Leinenweber's opinion was pretty stern. He said, you guys chose the forum. You guys said that they have to go to AAA, and so that was your right, but that's your arbitration provision, and you must pay the $311,000, and we'll see. I'm sure it's probably going to be appealed, but it's it can have big impact for companies not just like Samsung, but any company that gets these kind of not repetitive, but kind of common themes of violations, Fair Credit Reporting Act, or here at BIPA, or whatever the case may be. And I think in this case, it's probably the Samsung. It must be a facial identity or something on the phone. So I'm not quite sure what the underlying BIPA claims are here, Pat. But in any event, an interesting BIPA development.
So on the same day, February 15th, there was an argument before the Seventh Circuit in Walrick versus Samsung. And I'm posting about this in a couple days. And when Dan sent over this opinion, hey, let's talk about this as the rule of the, or as the BIPA development for the week, I said, started reading the opinion. It's like, I've seen something about this. And I had, because it's also an opinion from Judge Leinenweber. And it involves not 800 and some, but 30,000 Samsung customers. So, and he ordered there too, but he ordered that, compelled arbitration, but then he stayed the proceedings. But there was a problem. And I will quote Judge Easterbrook, quote, "We have urged all of our district courts to issue proper final decisions. Six out of the seven of our districts do so. Your case happens to be in the seventh." So apparently in the Northern District, that's in the same building, for those that aren't familiar, as the Seventh Circuit, they didn't get the memo. We need a final we need a final order. So apparently Judge Leinenweber issued memorandum opinion and an order, but he didn't issue a separate order. And so as a consequence, he also stayed the case, and Judge Easterbrook was like, what was left to stay if the only relief sought was to compel arbitration?
Right.
He didn't seem to get a good answer to that. So I went back and I looked at the Hoeg decision, which is the one that Dan started with, and there was an amended order issued on February 20th. It seems that there was a separate minute order making it a final judgment, but it's interesting he denied the motion to stay in both orders. Because I think maybe he got the memo that he was being chastised that day in the Seventh Circuit about what he did. So maybe he fixed it in the Hoeg case after what happened in the morning in the Walrick case. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he issued the opinions earlier in the day. I don't know. But and I couldn't really tell the difference between the amended opinion and the original opinion. They seem to be the same length, and I couldn't really tell the substantive difference, but something happened because he amended the order. So this is kind of a halfway BIPA-GIPA thing, but also a rule of the week, kind of a rule of the week thing.
Right.
So with that brings us to our prediction sure to go wrong. We were 2-0 this week. Dan is 293.5, 61.5, and 21. I am 290.5, 64.5, and 21. We got Bryant versus Chupac right from episode 175. And I can't help but give some turns of phrase from Judge Easterbrook. He's like an endless fount of entertainment, right? Unintentionally so. You just hope you're not the object of it. And I'm sure the next time I'm in front of him, I'll get it, but good. Because that's what he's equal opportunity. Everyone gets it. So he was unhappy with they didn't cite a case. So this is a case where there was a foreclosure in state court. The issue involves Rooker Feldman. The question of what the finality of the foreclosure judgment in the underlying case is at issue. And among the defendants were the banks, but also the judge, Judge Chupac, who now sits in the general chancery division, having moved over from the mechanics lien, where they would handle foreclosure matters. But he's now in the general chancery division, and I appear in front of him with some regularity. We'll deal with Judge Chupac and his role in this case in a moment. But Judge Easterbrook brought up an oral argument, and then in his opinion, this case called HSBC Bank versus Townsend, in which they held, what is and what is not a final judgment, yada, yada. And he says, we must apply the doctrine, and the doctrine he's referring to is Rooker-Feldman, correctly, no matter how poorly the issues were briefed in the district court. Zing. And then he continues, because Judge Chupac, who obviously wasn't in, you know, he had absolute immunity. He couldn't argue the lack of jurisdiction because he was the trial judge. But you sue the trial judge in a case where you're claiming you're not actually appealing the trial judge's ruling. Judge Easterbrook writes, someone who wants to present a claim that is assertedly independent of the state litigation embarrasses that effort by suing the state judge, which leads the federal court to think that the state court judgment is exactly what the federal suit concerns, end quote. So yes, just zinging everybody all around because they sued a judge because they didn't cite the seminal case on the topic. As we always say in the Seventh Circuit, know their decisions.
Yeah. Even if they were out yesterday.
Especially if they were out yesterday.
Yeah.
Be ready. Don't play. And I, as I read you the opinion, I noted they cite, you know, they'll cite a Supreme Court of the United States opinion for something, and then they'll immediately cite a Seventh Circuit case that stands for the same proposition. It's like, oh, we said it too.
Right.
You know, we mean it. We follow our bosses in Washington. We do our thing. So, you know, always the Seventh Circuit is a place you better follow the rules or things are not going to go well for you. Very important. All right. Yep. Then we had Wilson versus Donde from episode 153 from the 5th District. Dan, did you have a chance to review this one, or am I?
Nah. Yeah, please do it.
You have to
yeah.
listen to me tell you about this one. All right. Very
yeah.
important case in Med Mal in Illinois. This deals with, so the plaintiff dies. No autopsy is done. He was scheduled for a cardiac catheterization, but he dies before he gets it. The claim was is that he wasn't told to be sedentary between the time that it was found that he needed the procedure and the time of the procedure, and he dies before he gets the procedure. Well, because there was no autopsy, no one knows why he died. His wife just found him slumped over his lawnmower out mowing the pasture one morning. And so the defendant had an expert who testified as to a series of possibilities. And the court said, number one, that that expert could testify to possible causes of the deceased's death. But also, the trial court did not err in not showing the death certificate that had a cause of death on it, because there was no foundation laid for the opinions of the coroner, who may not even necessarily be a doctor. So that opinion did not come in, and so the judgment of the trial court, the judgment of the jury, I'll get this right yet. The jury verdict that was entered as a judgment, finding in favor of the defense, was affirmed. Important case if you do Med Mal. Which brings us to our prediction sure to go wrong this week. Progressive Universal versus Lonsdale. I think that's getting affirmed, Dan, even though I think it's the wrong outcome, but because of this the appellate issue, I think that they've got a real problem there. Your thoughts, Dan?
I agree. Yep.
Lil Bianco's being reversed.
Yep.
And Martin's getting certified. I don't think the Seventh Circuit. I don't think we're going to get a ruling. I think we're going to get a certification.
I think so. And again,
what should happen?
Yeah, especially we talked about a week or two ago when Daco butchered that case. Yeah, where they got it wrong. You know, so it's
At least according to the First District, we'll see what
Supreme
Court has to say.
All right,
Supreme Court's going to take that case, and then we'll find out the answer.
Right.
Maybe the First District got it right. Maybe the First District got it wrong. I sure hope they got it right, because I much prefer that answer.
Right.
But we'll see. Which brings us to the rule of the week. And Dan has taken to calling these patsters. We'll have Dansters before too long, but this is a patster. We've had Corey Websters of the week, but this is a patster. ABA Standard 208, the greatest self-own in the history of the rules of professional conduct. ABA Standard 208 says, law schools, you must have free speech policies. You must enforce free speech policies. Two thumbs up for the ABA. You don't hear me say that very often.
Yeah.
Outstanding rule. There's a problem. Model Rule 8.4G says that practicing lawyers, not so much on the free speech. So I have a question. if an adjunct professor who's a practicing lawyer says something in politic, but within the scope of their teaching, like they're teaching a free speech class, and they use an offensive word, name your offensive word, because they're trying to illustrate the point as to what is cover, what is fighting words, what is incitement, this kind of a thing. They use an offensive word. Which rule covers them? The standard under which they're teaching at the law school, or the rule of professional conduct under 8.4G if their state has adopted that? Or, as I say in my column on this topic, Illinois Supreme Court's considering a proposal from the ISBA, which largely, though not entirely, adopts or proposes to adopt 8.4G, its proposal 22-06. So we've got a couple law schools here in Illinois, and I would be worried if I were a practicing lawyer, which rule I was governed by, if we were to adopt this rule. I'd really want to know which one I'm, because the law school can't punish me, but the ARDC and the Supreme Court can. I'm confused. They should pick up a rule. The rule should obviously be consistent with the First Amendment. 8.4G and its versions are plainly not obvious, in my view, obviously not, intentionally not. So we can't have this incongruity. If free speech is good for law students, law faculty, and law professors, you know, whether they're practicing lawyers or not, it should be good enough for practicing lawyers. That doesn't mean that you go get to sexually harass and discriminate. Of course it doesn't. That's ridiculous. That's the false binary that's being offered. But it does mean you get to say things that may be in politic and not lose your license for it. Anyway, that's the rule of the week, which really is a soapbox of the week.
Yep, and I have nothing to add to that, Pat. we've thought about this before, and
doesn't get old. I wish the Supreme Court would just rule on the issue, issue the rule, and then we would know. They've ruled on another proposal that was up that day.
All right.
That we can now count sexual harassment prevention training, which as a supervisor, I have to take 2 hours of every year. Thank you. You have to anyway.
Illinois, every company, law firm to barbershop, everything has to, if you got more than a couple employees, you must do mandatory.
Well, that's my point. I killed two birds with one stone. It'll count as CLE credit and my sexual harassment training. I have to take because if I were a supervisor, I only have to take 1 hour of it, but I have to take 2. So don't become a supervisor. But now I get CLE credit for it. So we'll have to.
There you go.
Outstanding. And that training generally consists of keep your hands to yourself. Yeah. Right. I you know what I learned that in kindergarten.
Right.
They told me don't touch the little girls. That's what they said. So
or the boys or anybody, right?
Or anybody. Don't touch anybody. Anybody. Keep your hands to yourself.
Right.
Very simple.
Yeah,
don't touch anybody.
You got your own personal space and stay in it.
Stay in it. That's good. And don't say offensive stuff. Yeah, okay.
Right.
I 2 hours of that every year. I don't know how much sexual harassment's being prevented. If you're going to sexually harass, there's no amount of training that's going to tell you not to do that. But great. We'll tell them again.
Right.
And get CLE credit for it. I somehow think learning what a final order is, as was missed as we talked earlier, would have been a better use of the time, but that's just me. CLE should be about legal education, don't do something you already know not to do and you're already required to take. We should have more, if you think CLE is good, and I don't, but if you think CLE is good, you should do more CLE. About substantive issues, not less of it, about things you already have to do. I don't understand the purpose of this rule. It's entirely pointless, but now we have it. Entirely, it's frankly counterproductive, but there we are.
Soapbox put away.
Yeah, I guess kind of a different one. This is dumb. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, the intention is fine, but think this through a little bit, considering what Illinois law is. If Illinois law weren't what Illinois law is, then perhaps I could see a reason. But Illinois law is what it is.
Yep.
So with that, we will take our leave. And we'll see you next week on the Podium and Panel podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.